affordable, and SunCommon makes it easy to save money and go solar. Check out suncommon.com.
Okay, we're back at the State House in Montpelier. Thanks for joining us on the program this morning. And coming up next hour, we're going to be talking with Governor Shumlin, and also we'll be talking with Senator Kevin Mullen. You can join us at 244-1777. That's our local number in Central Vermont. You can also reach us on our toll-free lines at 877-291-8255. Well, gosh, we thought we might actually get a citizen's perspective here on an issue, and joining us here right now is Heidi Speer. Heidi is with a organization, a citizen-led group, the Accountable Education Funding Working Group. Let's see, does that have an acronym that it comes up with there? No, actually, AFWG or something. And we're going to talk about some of their ideas when it comes to property tax reform. Heidi is on the school board. Where?
Faiston Elementary School.
Okay, thanks for joining us. How are you this morning?
Thank you. I'm great. Thanks for having me on.
So let's talk about the Accountable Education Funding Working Group. I'm not going to ask who came up with that name, but how is it formed? Who is it, and what's the goal?
Okay, so it was originally formed as an outgrowth of a community education funding forum that we held in the Washington West Supervisory Union. We recognized, like a lot of school board members, and originally the smaller group was school board members, that we needed our communities to be better educated about our education funding system. There was so much confusion and so little opportunity on town meeting day to really inform voters about why the property taxes kept going up. So we thought, let's not continue to try to cram this into a couple of hours on town meeting day. Let's give it the time that it needs, that it requires. We created a panel. We held an event. And at that event, it just tipped. It just moved from being school board members organizing as a task force to a broad citizen-led group where we all recognize it's not enough to identify the problems or get educated on the problems, but really we need to participate in crafting solutions to address the continued rise in education spending and also the climb in property taxes themselves.
When you say it tipped, what do you mean by that, and what happened?
Well, I think we thought prior to that we wouldn't get that kind of help from the community, you know, that they would just be, throwing darts at us as property taxpayers. You know, a lot of people are very upset about this. Of course, all school board members are also property taxpayers, but we'd been kind of painted in this position by the governor last year. I don't know if you remember.
Right.
But so there was some degree of defensiveness. And what we found was, true partnership and the willingness that, you know, a recognition that too few new ideas were coming out of the State House, to be honest, and that there was such great attachment to the current system that they birthed themselves, that they could not see it for what it was, and that we needed people outside of the State House to be willing not just to criticize, but to give it serious thought. And that began within 2 months of that forum. We had our first sit down. It included a wide range of people, business people, teachers, parents, people, nonprofit executives, you know, just a wide variety of people, former legislators, current legislators came, but it remained citizen-led, and we took the time, since we came from a broad array of backgrounds, and some people were more concerned about property taxes than education quality, for example, to really define what's our goal, you know, what are the principles, and start to think about how could we approach this differently? How can we be Brigham compliant, which we all held as a core value, that there be equity of opportunity for students across the state, without bankruptizing us all, right?
So did you start with a blank piece of paper? How do you even, this is the Gordian knot, the Rubik's Cube, whatever you want, analogy you want to use, that no one's been able to really seemingly to figure out. So how do you start with a blank piece of paper?
So to some degree, what we did was I created a blog to support the work, and that had a resource page which went through, you know, here are the studies that have been done on our education funding, here is the Brigham decision, you know, here's Act 60, here's Act 68, and we started just educate ourselves and share that information, and that's, it's a public blog, anyone can look at it.
What's the name of it?
It's Fix, VT, edfunding.com. So you can really see the work that took place, who went to the first meeting, second, third, fourth, notes from those meetings, the design document, which really outlined, you know, these are what we believe are the core principles that must drive the work. These are the goals of the work. What we aim to achieve. And then we broke into smaller study circles. Not everybody who was there at the group had the time or the capacity to really start fine-tuning a proposal. So we went into a smaller, you know, study circle for the last couple of months and then came back to the broader group with the proposal. The proposal is up on that website, on that blog. But we've also created a Facebook page. Vermonters for Accountable Education Funding. So we're hoping that more people will take the time to look at these proposals and give feedback. They have been shared with the legislature before the end of the year, as the speaker had requested. So we're hoping it can have an impact.
We're talking with Heidi Spear. She's with the Accountable Education Funding Working Group. So let's talk about the proposal that you came out with. Can you No, describe it for our listeners.
Yeah, I think I can. You know, it's
well,
difficult.
I have to be able to. That's the key.
So what we did was, instead of approaching it from the standpoint of continuing to try and tweak our current system, which we see as not Brigham compliant, to lift our gaze and look to the broader country. We aren't the only state that has this goal of providing an excellent education at a reasonable cost. Other states seek to do this as well. And in fact, there are many states that provide excellent education at significantly lesser cost. So we started to look at, how do they do that? And the way that they do it is a funding system that's in wide and effective use, called adequacy funding. So we wanted to delve in and understand that system better. I spoke at length with the chairwoman that works on a committee in Massachusetts about what they did. We looked at studies. What could we learn from them? We all really believed that reinventing the wheel here was not a good idea. We needed to reliably be successful to contain the costs and support the quality of education. So that's, I think, a distinguishing characteristic of this proposal, is that it leverages a system that's already in use today. Another distinguishing characteristic is, with our approach, the impact of spending decisions will be perfectly clear to voters. Okay? That, I think, is the element of our current system that is hugely problematic, right? I mean, at the one hand, voters are up in arms about rising property taxes, and yet we keep approving expenditures that are going up and up, you know? So one solution that has been advanced through other proposals is just, you know, let's pull the plug on the local voter. And I do not believe that democracy, and nobody in our group believed that democracy, was the root of the problem here. The problem is the complexity of the system that doesn't allow voters any longer since Act 60 to understand the ramifications of their vote. So we bring it to the point of absolute clarity. And in by doing so, we don't have to undermine democracy, right?
So, but how do you do that? Talk to me about that one element. How do you make it a local decision, a local effect?
We do that by using adequacy funding to define what are the resource requirements that schools need in order to deliver an excellent education, and what's a reasonable cost for delivering that service. Okay, statewide,
okay.
And that funding level is across the entire state. It is provided statewide funding. If a community decides to spend beyond that level, okay, they vote for it locally and they pay for it locally. All right, so the accountability is restored. Now, in recognition of the Brigham ruling, right, the Brigham ruling and why our prior system was found unconstitutional is because we didn't support sufficient equity of opportunity. But the reason why we didn't at that time was because opportunity hinged upon local community wealth. All right. So we need to acknowledge that in certain communities there is greater wealth. So if you were to take that system and say, vote for whatever you want at this point, from this point forward, you'd see a growing disparity.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
Something we don't want. So what
right.
we've done is we've borrowed some wisdom from Major League Baseball and suggested a luxury tax. So for those
right.
communities, like, you know, those New Yorkers, and they have all this wealth, and
the Yankees can hire
whoever they
too.
Want, right?
Yeah.
There's a penalty you got to pay for that, okay? So we didn't set forth, because I think the study really needs to take place, what those percentages should be, but let's say 20% or 30%, you'd have a luxury tax, and that tax, those dollars would be raised to distribute and elevate the opportunity that's available to all communities. But the third element, I think, is distinct, and it really ties into the second one, is that this proposal would support equity of opportunity across all of our schools. We don't have that today. Our current system is not Brigham compliant.
You said that before. How so?
Well, it's interesting because right now we have Secretary Holcomb has been tasked with traveling across the state, meeting with all the school boards to actually share the tremendous inequity of opportunity that we have in the state today. Okay, what's interesting about that is it isn't then followed up with a, yes, we acknowledge that our current funding system is not Brigham compliant, even though that is the basic ruling of Brigham, but to try and push school boards to consolidate. And, you know, school boards will consolidate with neighboring districts when it makes sense for them to do so. Our current funding system undermines the accountability that would allow for these mergers to unfold. Okay, now we have these situations in schools all the time where children are disruptive and the learning of other students can't happen, and we could take the approach of saying, you know, sit down and shut up so we can just move forward with educating, right?
Okay.
That isn't really the best approach, and I don't think that's the way we should handle it with local voters, okay? Their interests need to be aligned and there needs to be clarity for the decisions that are made. And right now there just aren't. The details. Education funding is complex. The proposal is in writing. There's a 2-page summary. There's a 6-page document. And I hope that your listeners will take the time to look at it and approach all of us with questions.
Okay. Remind us again what the site is where they would find
that. So the Facebook site for those who are into social networking is Vermonters for Accountable Education Funding. And the blog is fixvtedfunding.com.
Okay. We're talking with Heidi Speer. If you'd like to join us on the program, you can at 244-1777 is our local number. Toll free 877-291-8255. It sounds at first blush, what I'm hearing is that there would be a significantly higher rate for per pupil spending that would be kind of the base. Is that fair to say?
Well, right now, our base spending amount is not a reflection of what it takes to educate students, right?
Right.
It isn't. It's just a mechanism and a formula. And, our formula is really a blunt instrument. I don't buy into the speaking points that are widely distributed within our administration and our legislators that this is some wonderful system. It's really actually very simplistic in terms of the variables for costs. We need to be much, much clearer about what are the resource requirements, what are the different populations of need, and specify those so we can have greater fairness. Because right now we do have communities that are resourced at 10,000 per student schools, and then we have schools that are resourced at over 30,000 for every student in their building. No, it doesn't correlate to local property wealth anymore. Hooray for us. But when opportunity is so varied and when the resources available are that disparate, we have to acknowledge we have a problem, and we haven't solved the fundamental problem of equity.
Would the plan that you're talking about, how would it facilitate consolidation that the current plan doesn't?
Well, in those communities that are delivering education of insufficient quality, or doing a maybe okay job but terribly cost ineffectively, right, without the cost effectiveness that we need or expect of our school boards, they wouldn't have the resources to continue to operate in that fashion. The proposal includes accountability mechanisms so that if there's insufficient opportunity, there would be an appraisal or a licensing of that school, just as we currently have for private schools. If they aren't living up and delivering for the resources that are made available to every school based upon this formula, based upon a reasonable cost, if they can't get the job done, then action has to be taken. Likewise, if they are unable to do what they want to do for those resources, naturally they would look to the neighboring community to say, well, together. And these conversations, by the way, are happening all over the state. They're happening within our own Washington West Supervisory Union. If we were to work together, if we were to bring our students together, what would that look like for kids? Would we be able to provide them with better opportunities, larger, healthier cohort groups? Would we be able to deliver this higher quality education education, this great social experience at lesser expense? If the answer is yes, we should move forward. But right now, there's so little clarity about the impact of the decisions and so much buffering for the consequences of spending decisions that those decisions don't make sense. I mean, I hear it and I've heard it said by others as well. Communities will not get behind these ideas because they believe other people are spending tons of money to educate their students. Why shouldn't we?
Right.
You know, it functions like a tragedy of the commons.
244-1777 is our local number. Toll free, 877-291-8255. We've been talking with Heidi Speer. Her organization is the Accountable Education Funding Working Group. Let's take a couple of calls here. We go to New Haven. Lowell, good morning. How are you this morning?
Yes, good morning. I'm curious as to why people keep insisting that consolidation is going to be the answer. The study that I looked to, there's a number of studies that were done on school consolidation, and there was one that was done in West Virginia, and it showed that after they consolidated their schools, which they did all at once in this big movement, that the cost of the education actually went up, the administrative cost went up, and the test scores went down. So I think that people seem to have this idea that consolidation makes sense because it makes sense, but there's really no evidence that that's the case. And the only study that I could find that showed that consolidation made sense was a study that was done by the funded by Harvester, which makes school buses. So I think that can tell you what they're all about, because consolidation means you're going to need more school buses and the kids are going to spend more time on the bus.
All right.
So
thanks for your call.
Has actually read some of those studies, academic studies that have been done on consolidation.
Okay. All right. Thanks for your call, Lowell. I appreciate it.
Yes. I think you raise a very important point here that there is this huge effort that went into the last legislative session to force consolidation, this idea that consolidation was the ticket. That was the way that we were going to deliver quality education for less money. And I agree that that isn't necessarily the case. We have our largest districts in the state spending more students in the largest districts in our state spending over $30,000 for every student in the building than we have in small schools. Okay, so why would we assume that consolidating would save us money if the big schools aren't operating any more efficiently? And the reason why they aren't operating more efficiently, I believe, is because of the funding system itself. I do think that there are opportunities for consolidation to take place that might offer some amount of cost savings. The point is that those local communities would know best if those opportunities exist. I think there are reasons to consolidate that aren't just rooted in dollars. When populations of students get very, very small, it can be hard to go through school without, you know, an intellectual peer, having a small classroom size of 9 kids that has just 2 girls or 3 girls. I mean, this shouldn't just be looked at on the basis of costs, is my belief. And I worked very hard last year to fight legislation that was basically providing incentives, providing tax breaks to communities if they consolidated, whether they delivered their education for less money or not, which is just a way of cost shifting, just saying get on board here, whether you actually improve education or save money or not, which I am. It's just not not appropriate. The unintended consequences and the cost increases that would result from that, I think, are inevitable. So I'm not against consolidation. I'm against statewide mandated consolidation. I'm for aligning people's incentives so that where it makes sense, school boards and voters will take appropriate action.
Let's go to Waterbury. Kathy, good morning.
Hello?
Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, I'm just wondering if people have given some thought to putting a statewide teachers contract back on the table. That's about 85 to 90% of some school budgets. Right now, I think that's part of the equity problem. Some of the towns in the Northeast Kingdom can't even get special educators or speech-language pathologists. Because, you know, their salary scales and things are so different than some of the Chittenden County schools. And if you took that big hunk of teacher salaries out, in addition to, like, the administrative salaries, Then what you have left is what people could really talk about and vote on and understand in their local school budget. And it, I don't think it's such a horrible idea, since the biggest bill in the state of Vermont is a state employees union, or one of the biggest bills, and they have a statewide union. And if you are a social worker in Cayman, you get the same money or the same pensions or whatever as someone in Chittenden County. And I think the time has come for that. And this year, over the next 5 years, a lot of, probably 50% of the teachers will be retiring. So it's a good time to flatten out that scale. And then that's okay. Something that could be controlled each year, instead of having everyone fight it out and having strikes.
Okay. I'm going to interrupt there. Thank you, Kathy. I appreciate your call. Let me see what Heidi has to say about that.
So as we kind of mentioned at the start of this discussion, this working group was focused on developing and promoting education funding policy that addresses Vermont's rising tide of education spending and property taxes. And unfortunately, moving to a common contract for all of our teachers would have a negative impact on both of those two things. And that's because there currently is significant disparity between what teachers are paid in some regions versus others. And if we were to roll up to a single contract, you roll up. You don't roll down, okay? So I agree that it's not a good thing that teachers in more rural communities aren't paid that higher wage, but the reality stems from a funding system that works on scale. Like, there, it is a directly linear formula. So those communities that have large schools, there is no expectation of economy of scale, and their spending is essentially discounted. And smaller communities really struggle to actually deliver the education that those children deserve and need to thrive in today's world. And that's why I think we need to deal with the formula. I mean, it'd be great to get there. I really think it'd be great to get there, but absent funding reform, I think we can expect property taxes to spike and education spending to spike, taking that action.
We're talking with Heidi Speer about property taxes. You can find her blog at fixvtedfunding.com. We just have a couple of minutes left here. Let's talk about where you go forward with this from here. So you've come up with this plan. It sounds a little more understandable than most of the ones that I've heard. So what do you do with it? How do you take it forward here?
Well, what we did was we put together the entire proposal. We skinnied it down to 2 pages. Representative Dave Sharp recommended that, so that it was more consumable by legislators. And he has said that I will be able to provide testimony for the House Committee on Education. I've reached out to a number of senators. But it really is, I think, going to be about community action, people educating themselves, deciding what they think is the best path forward and reaching out to their legislators. Because as I said, I think there is obviously a declared open-mindedness about education funding reform this legislative session, right? This is what the speaker says he wants to do. I just think there's a strong attachment to the system that they birthed. It really is very difficult for them to look honestly and frankly at the outcome of that system.
Well, you don't want to be criticizing your kids, do you? Sort of the same thing.
Yes.
So summarize for us, this formula would be better than the current formula because why?
Because it's a proven effective formula. We're not reinventing the wheel. Okay, we can deliver a higher quality education, a high quality education at a reasonable cost. Other states do it. We can do this in a way that provides a clear indicator to voters of the impact of their spending decisions. That's required for accountability. That's required for spending restraint. And we can do that without undermining local democracy. Very important. And further, we can actually have substantially equitable education opportunity across the state, something we don't currently have.
What's happened and faced in, say, the past 3 to 5 years in property taxes?
Are you trying to make me cry?
No, not at all. No, I would criticize your children, I guess, first to do that. What's happened in Facetown?
Yeah. We are one of those regions that is suffering from falling enrollment. So while we do our best to contain spending, you know, the formula itself, the equal education spending per equalized pupil formula works against us. In the town of Feaston, we're the only town that I saw this last year where our total expenditures per the actual number of students we educate was less than the education spending per equalized pupil. So we were taxed as if we were spending more. We're not favored by the formula. It's a tough run. We definitely are seeing year-over-year tax rate increases that are very difficult for taxpayers to understand because it is far in excess of the increases in the actual expenditures.
Well, I mean, this whole disconnect between what a budget is and what the per pupil spending, I mean, you know, frankly, I didn't really understand that connection, and I'm guessing probably, you know, 95% of the people out there didn't.
People do not understand it. Legislators do not understand it. I heard your program one time.
Paul Cielo and Jack Hoffman.
Yeah, where he's like blaming the media for the confusion. Are you kidding me? And the formula itself is, it just completely masks huge discrepancies in resource availability, and it doesn't give the voters the information they need to make smart decisions.
Thank you for your time this morning. Again, we encourage you to go to fixvtedfunding.com to find out more about Heidi's organization. That's going to wrap things up for hour number one. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Keep your dial right here, FM 96.1 WDEV Warren, broadcasting from the top of Sugarbush, FM 96.5 in Barrie, Montpelier, AM 550 WDEV, Waterbury, Montpelier, News is next. AP.